Les colloques du Collège de France.
And okay, and for the last talk of the morning, it's a pleasure to introduce Ramon van Randel, who came from Princeton, and who will present the polynomial method.
Oh, yes. Thank you very much, Nandini. Thank you very much for the invitation to be here. I mean, it's a really great workshop with a broad range of mathematics. So I will talk about the polynomial method, which is a joint work with lots of great co-authors over the past couple of years. Usually it's not a very good idea to give a talk about a method, right? Because it's kind of boring. And it's better to give a talk about the result, which is exciting and wonderful. But there's kind of two reasons why I decided to do it. The first one is that this method has already had quite a number of applications to really quite diverse models. So, for example, all of the main models of random hyperbolic surfaces, many models of strong convergence, which Michael will talk about later this afternoon. So I couldn't really choose, so I decided to just give a talk about the method. And the other reason to talk about the method is that every time you apply this method, it seems like a little miracle happens at some point or other. And so what I hope to try to kind of explain is where this little miracle is coming from. Okay, so it's neither a talk about a specific result nor a talk about a tutorial on how to use this method, but rather I'm going to try to explain what is going on. Okay, at least to the best I can. So let's work with a general setting. Not quite general, but I mean, let's work with a simple setting which we can think about. So let Xn be an n by n self-adjoint random matrix. So, and we're thinking of letting the dimension n go to infinity. Okay. So of course, if you work with a Laplacian on a hyperbolic surface, you don't want a random matrix, but you want a random operator. Okay, but the method will work basically the same way. Okay, and there are two basic properties of convergence, spectral convergence, that we will talk about, which are weak convergence. So what does weak convergence mean? So weak convergence means that if we take, for the empirical distribution of the eigenvalues of this matrix, that it converges to some limiting distribution, some limiting probability measure. So we saw it in Alice's talk. Let me write it in my notation. So for example, if I take the moments, right? So for me, this little trace is always the average, right? The empirical measure of the eigenvalue. So I put mass 1 over n at each eigenvalue, right? So this is just, right, the 1 over n times sum I is 1 to n of the ith eigenvalue to the power p, right? The empirical moment of the eigenvalue distribution converges to some limiting distribution, which I will call mu zero for reasons that will become clear later. For all p. So just so we're on the same page, right? So these moments are just the average with an expectation. You write it like this. It's just the average, k is 1 to n, of the eigenvalues to the power p, right? And this mu zero x to the p is just the integral of x to the p with respect to some measure. So the moments of the eigenvalues converge to the moment to this limiting measure. So this is called weak convergence. And the other property is norm convergence, which means that we're interested in the extreme eigenvalues, so the edges of the spectrum. So this will be that the norm of these matrices converges as n goes to infinity to the edges of this distribution. Right? So for example, I could write this as the maximum of the absolute values of x, where x is in the support of this limiting distribution. So if the distribution of the eigenvalues converges to this limiting distribution, you would think that the maximal eigenvalues converge to the edges of this distribution. Right? That's a natural thing to expect. Right? So let's. I will work with a running example, which is kind of the simplest example of this. Situation, just to have something concrete to talk about. So we could take Xn to be the adjacency matrix of a random D-regular graph on n vertices. Now, if I have the adjacency matrix of a graph, of a D-regular graph, its largest eigenvalue is always D, which is not very interesting, right? So we're not interested in that guy. We're interested in the next one. So I will take it restricted to the orthogonal complement of the largest eigenvector, right? I'm just going to remove this trivial eigenvalue D so that we look at the first non-trivial eigenvalue, okay? So this is a random matrix.
Sorry, did I yes. Have
that means every vertex has D edges coming out? That's exactly right, right? So every vertex has exactly D edges coming out. So if I take, so the sum of every row is D, so the vector of all ones is an eigenvector of eigenvalue D. That's the trivial eigenvalue. That's like the eigenvalue zero of the Laplacian. We don't care about that one because it's always there. So I'm just going to work on the orthogonal complement of that eigenvector. Okay. Good. So in this case, these things are known to converge weakly. That follows, for example, from Benjamin-Isham convergence, like you saw in Alice's talk. And the nu zero is a very well-known distribution. It might look something like this. The so-called Keston-McKay distribution. Here is one of them. The distribution depends on D, of course, the degree of the graph. But the distribution might look something like this. So-called Keston-McKay distribution. Right? So if I look at the eigenvalues of this matrix, in the limit, the distribution of those eigenvalues converges to some function like this. And this is for some D. It looks like that. I think D equals 3 or 4. It looks like something like this. And the support of this distribution is between minus 2 square root d minus 1 and 2 square root d minus 1, right? So if you see this distribution, you would think, well, that the norm of this matrix had better converge to 2 square root d minus 1, and that would be the statement of norm convergence, okay? So norm convergence says that the norm of this matrix converges to 2 square root d minus 1 as n goes to infinity. I've been a bit vague what I mean by convergence of this random variable. I mean in probability in this case. But that's a minor detail, okay? This is a famous result due to Friedman. So this fact was known. It was one of the first results of this kind. I mean for these kind of very sparse random matrices. And it inspired a lot of the developments in this area that have happened more recently. Okay? So there are now many very deep, let's say, extensions of Friedman's results to much more complicated model. Okay? But this is one of the earliest results in this area. So that's just an example of these two notions of convergence. Okay? And I'm going to use it as my running example. So what is the problem? So the kind of general problem with establishing these kinds of convergence is that typically establishing weak convergence is rather easy, and establishing norm convergence is rather hard, okay, or at least much harder. And there's a very basic reason, which is that if I look at these moments, for example, these are just polynomials of the entries of the matrix, right? Some fixed polynomial of degree p of the entries of the matrix. So if you have some kind of explicit description of the distribution of the entries of the matrix, you can generally write down a formula for this, right? And you can try to analyze it as n goes to infinity, because this will be a fixed degree object. So for example, in our running example of random graphs, okay, what will typically happen is that this will be some very explicit function. It will be some rational function of n, okay? And you can just write it down. It's not a, you know, simple function. And in particular, if you increase p, this will become a higher and higher degree object, right? So it will become more and more complicated. But you have some formula, and if you fix p and you let n go to infinity, the asymptotics of it are kind of elementary, okay? On the other hand, the norm, this is a very complicated function, right? I mean, this is a very nonlinear function of the matrix, right? So we don't really have access to formulas, except in one case, which is GUE, basically. You know, for most random matrices, we cannot compute the distribution of the norm explicitly, and so somehow what we have to do is we have to go from statistics that we can compute, like these moments, to the norm. And that's the key problem of understanding norm convergence. Okay, so we need some technique to go from here to here. That's the idea. Okay? So, so for comparison, let me talk for a little bit about the most classical way of doing this, which is which is called the moment method. So the idea of the moment method is the following. So if we look at this, right? So what is weak convergence saying? Which convergence, for example, means that the expected trace, I'm just rewriting the definition, right? Okay. So this is certainly bounded by the norm, right? Or the, let's say, the limiting object here. Let me call this rho, just so I can use it as a notation. So this is certainly bounded by rho. Here I chose p to be even, right? So I just have something non-negative, right? So the weak convergence says that this is true for every p, right? For every fixed p. And the idea of the moment method is that if this is still true when p is allowed to grow with n, sufficiently quickly, so much faster than log n, right? Then we get norm convergence as a consequence. And the argument is very simple, because you see, what is the norm of xn? That's just the maximum of the absolute values of the eigenvalues, right? So the maximum of the absolute values of the eigenvalues is certainly bounded by the LP norm of the eigenvalues for every p, right? So this is certainly bounded by, let's say, the big trace, if, at least when p is even, right? Because this is the sum of the eigenvalues to the power p, right? When p is even, this is lower bounded by any eigenvalue to the power p. If I do it to 1 over p, I just get an upper bound on all the eigenvalues, right? Now, the big trace is big n times the little trace, right? The little trace is the normalized trace, so this is big n times the little trace. And now, if I want to, for example, compute the expectation, I can do it like this. So I could take this, okay? And if this were still true, right, if we still got this inequality for large n of p, right, we would have this bounded by n to the 1 over p, because I get this n to the 1 over p, times rho. And the point is that when p grows faster than log n to the 1 over p converges to 1, and then you have an exact upper bound. I concentrate on the upper bound because the lower bound actually follows very easily from weak convergence, right? If you have weak convergence, you know that the empirical distribution of the eigenvalues could go to this. That means there are very many eigenvalues over here, right? So weak convergence implies the lower bound. So we only really need to think about the upper bounds of convergence, right? So you see, basically, norm convergence would follow from weak convergence if you could have the convergence of the moments, but where the moments grow quickly enough as a function of the dimension of the matrix. Is this clear? So that's a nice idea. And this is something that's classically used a lot in random matrix theory. Now, there are two problems with this approach. The first problem is just a problem of laziness, okay? Which is that you see when p is a fixed and you let n go to infinity, when p is fixed, typically the moments over here are simple functions, let's say some fixed rational function. If I have a rational function of, let's say, n or 1 over n, and I let n go to infinity, well, I can just see what terms survive in the limit. This is easy, right? But when I allow p to grow, basically these functions become more and more complicated, right? Because the degree of these rational functions will start growing, right? And so you have to work much harder, right? So the combinatorics becomes more and more intractable if you let p go quickly. But you know, you might hope that if you work hard enough, you could still do it, right? I mean, it just becomes more difficult. But there is a more fundamental problem, which is that this statement that I wrote over here is simply not true in the kind of models that we're talking about. So not only is it hard, but it's not true, okay? Which makes it even harder to prove that it is true, right? So the reason it's not true, I will explain now, is that for these kinds of sparse random graphs, so these are slightly different kinds of sparse random graphs than were in Elise's talk, you have bad things happening. So this property is just not true. And in our run, so now I'm talking about our running example, but the same phenomenon holds in other settings. So what happens in, for example, the example of deregular graphs, okay? For random deregular graphs, they might have some bad subgraphs. For example, if I have a random deregular graph, it could happen that I have d vertices which are just hooked up to each other, right? Which complete, they might have a subgraph which is a complete graph with d vertices, right? Now this doesn't happen with very high probability, but there's some probability that this will happen, right? This is allowed in a random deregular graph. Yes?
Do you want to say which model you are using?
No. It will happen in all of the models. Okay. Doesn't matter. If you can invent a model that is contiguous to one of the models which this doesn't happen, then you know, I mean, then you are dealing with that other problem. Okay, but this will happen in every reasonable model of randomly regular graphs, right? So you could have, for example, a complete graph of degree d as a subgraph, and this little graph has an eigenvalue d, right, which is much larger than 2 square root d minus 1. Now, in principle, this shouldn't be a problem because the probability that this will happen is small, right? This will happen with probability converging to zero. But the problem in these kinds of models is that the probability that you have these bad subgraphs converges to zero at too slow of a rate. Okay. So you might have a bad subgraph. So you have a bad subgraph, which Friedman calls a tangle. With probability which is only polynomially small in the dimension. Okay. So if it were exponentially small, you wouldn't have a problem. But here the probability is only polynomially small in the dimension. Right? And so you should think about a bad subgraph as being a declique, for example. There are many bad subgraphs, but for example, one of them would be a subgraph, right? A complete subgraph of degree d, right? So what would happen? So let's look at this quantity we're trying to compute. Right? So what is the expected trace of xn to the power p? Right? So this will be lower bounded by the probability that I have a bad subgraph, let's say n to the minus c, okay, times, well, for example, so I have something like let me do it with the big trace, right? So it'll be lower bounded by the probability times the size of the eigenvalue on that bad subgraph, which in this case will be d, right, to the power p. So if I do it to the power 1 over p, then I get what? I get something like n to some constant over p times d. Okay, but remember, when p is much larger than log n, this converges to 1, right? And then you get something which is way too large, right? When p is much larger than log. So this object over here is d is much larger than where the eigenvalue should go. Right? So even though the probability that these small subgraphs happens with probability going to zero, right? The probability is only polynomially small, and that means that when we take very, very large powers, those rare events start dominating, right? And they completely kill the ability to do these kind of estimates. Okay. So, for example, Friedman's proof, which was the original result in this area, like the major invention in that proof is that he found a way of somehow killing these bad events. And it caused huge complications. Okay, so the proof is like 100 pages long. Okay, so you have to, you know, it has since been simplified, but these kind of events make your life really a pain. This is a big problem in the polynomial, in the moment. Okay, so is this clear? So what I want to show you now is a little miracle. So I'm going to write down some kind of result that we can prove using this new method, using the polynomial method. This result I'm going to write down is not in itself enough to prove norm convergence, but I hope that it should illustrate what kind of is something strange is happening. So I want to emphasize that what this computation over here is showing is that the statistics we care about, right, the expected the moments, expected trace of x to the power p, are exponentially larger than the limits of what they should be, right? Because here I took the power 1 over p, right? So if I take this thing to the power p, the quantity I care about is of order d to the p, right? And d to the p is exponentially larger than 2 square root d minus 1 to the power p, right? So the limiting object is exponential, sorry, the moments are exponentially larger in p to the limiting object. That's what makes the moment method fit. Okay? So here is, I don't know what you want to call it, let's call it a theorem, which is the simplest outcome, the very first thing you prove of the polynomial method. Simplest. Okay. So to explain it, maybe I shouldn't have written theorem yet. Let's take a function h, which is just a univariate polynomial of some degree, fixed degree, q. Okay. Right. So I'm taking a polynomial of degree q, but of course a polynomial is nothing else than a linear combination of moments. Right? If I take, let me write it up here. If I take a polynomial of degree q, the expected trace of h of x to the n, right? So a polynomial is just a linear combination of monomials, right? This is just a linear combination of the moments. Okay. I mean, it's obvious, right? So let's take a polynomial of degree q, and let's look at the statistics of these polynomials, okay? But this should make no difference, right? I mean, this is just a linear combination of the objects we started with. And let's look at the difference between the statistics that the moments, let's say, and the limiting object. Okay? So the limiting object here will be mu zero of h, right? Which is just a linear combination of the limiting moments, right? The corresponding linear combination of the limiting moments. And here we have an estimate. So there is a constant. Okay, I'll give you some specific numbers, but even these numbers we can improve. Divided by n times the infinity norm of h on some interval, minus dd. So here's an estimate that we get using the polynomial method. And you know, the first time that we wrote down this estimate, I thought that there must be an error in the proof. Because this looks like an illegal estimate, right? I mean, this cannot be true. Because you see, this over here is just a linear combination of the moments minus the linear combination of the limiting moments, right? And we know that each of those moments, the terms here are exponentially larger than the terms here, exponentially larger in the degree, right? Not always, but when p is much larger than log n, right? The moments much larger than log n are exponentially larger than the limiting object, right? Because of the presence of tangles. But if I take the degree much larger than log n, for example, let's say I take the degree log n squared, then I'd have here log n to the 8th divided by n, which goes to 0, right? So I have here a bunch of stuff. This is exponentially larger than that, and the difference goes to 0, right? Which seems to be a mistake. Right. So there's something weird going on here, right? So first of all, let me clarify that there is actually not an error here, okay? Because, so what is going on? No, absolutely. It's, let me get back to this. I'm not sure, I think you're saying something that is not exactly what I mean. But let's see what happens. So the first thing that I should say is that I could, of course, right, this is true for any polynomial of degree q. So I could take here a moment, a special case of this inequality is just get an inequality for the moments themselves, right? So that would happen if I took h of x equals x to the p. Then I would just get over there the difference between the moment and the limiting moment, right? But this polynomial over here, if I took this polynomial over here, then the L infinity norm of this polynomial in interval minus dd is d to the p, which is exponentially large in p, right? So we get back our exponential bound on this side, right? The exponential part comes from this bounded polynomial. Does that make sense? So this L infinity bound over here would now become exponential, and there's no contradiction with what I wrote over there, right? But what this theorem is saying is that if h is bounded on the interval minus dd, then somehow or other there is some kind of massive cancellation going on. Okay. Then the effect of the tangles, right? So the they cancel, right? So each of the terms over here, right? Each of this is a linear combination of terms. Each of the terms is exponentially larger than that guy, but when I take the linear combination, there's some kind of cancellation, and all those bad events cancel. Okay. Now, what Michael is saying, I'm not quite sure. I think you're each of the individual terms.
You have cancellation before you write the minus sign, and then you have cancellation already before you write the minus sign in the thing, and then you get more cancellation from writing it.
Oh, you mean even if I have a bound without that?
Yeah.
That's okay. You're arguing with my simplest.
Yeah.
Okay. This is fair, but I think it would be hard to describe this in a. But I agree. Michael is saying I could have an estimate on this, which already has a polynomial in this. Absolutely. But okay, let's talk about it this way. So you see, there is something remarkable going on, right? This is a linear combination. What kills the moment method is that each of these moments is very bad. It's completely dominated by these rare events. But somehow, when I took the linear combination of these moments, those rare events that are completely killing the individual terms cancel, and I get something over here that is going to zero. Right? And this phenomenon is really at the core of what makes this method work. Okay? It's this kind of massive cancellation that is happening. And what I have to explain to you now is, A, where is this cancellation coming from? And B, how do we use it, right? Because of course, let's say I have such a cancellation, but in order to use this cancellation, I have to start here with bounded polynomials, right? And if I start with bounded polynomials, I cannot play the same reduction that we do in the moment method to go from the moments to the norm. So you have to do something else. Okay. So those are the two things that in the rest of my time, I'm actually doing quite well. In the rest of my time, I'm going to try to explain something about both of these things. But somehow this cancellation seems to me very surprising. You know, what is this? Why? Right. Now, I'm not sure how convincing of an answer I can give you to why, okay? But I will try to explain to you why it must be true. So, now, of course, we need something to run this method. Okay, so I now have to go back and explain to you what we use as input to this method. So let's go back to the moments. Okay, or for example, expect a trace of h of xn. Okay. So we pick some fixed polynomial, and we look at this as a function of n. Okay, so this is some function, depends on the choice of h, and it's typically a function of 1 over n. Okay. So as n goes to infinity, this converges to phi h of 0. Okay. That's the limiting object. And the polynomial method is based on the observation. The observation itself is not new, it's how we use it. But based on the observation that in all of these models to which this method applies, this phi h is actually a pretty nice function. Right? So remember, the h is a polynomial of degree q. And what is true in all of these models is that phi h is approximately a polynomial of degree approximately q, of order q, okay? Order q. So for now, I'm not telling you exactly what this means, and in fact, we have different settings. So I mean, this is what I'm saying here is not true for all random matrix models or for all random operator models, but it's true in all of the models to which this method applies, and we're going to use this fact, right? So this is the key fact that we use as input. So for example, for random regular graphs, you can just compute phi h. It's some rational function where the numerator and the denominator have degree about q proportional to q, right? And it's some complicated rational function, but it's a rational function, and rational functions behave like polynomials. Okay. So this certainly works. So in the models where the method applies, we will have this property. Now, what is new is how do we use this property? Okay? So normally, you know, you could say, well, it's some function, but you know, what do you care if it's polynomial? The point is, can you say something quantitative about this function? But we're actually going to use the fact that it's a polynomial, approximately a polynomial. So in order to explain that, let me do a thought experiment. Okay, so let's do a thought experiment. So suppose that there is no cancellation, right? So here I claim that there's some kind of cancellation happening, okay? So let's pretend for a moment that there's no cancellation. So I don't know how to explain why the cancellation happens, but what I'm going to show you, if that the cancellation didn't happen, something would go horribly wrong, okay? Therefore, the cancellation must happen, okay? So suppose there's no cancellation when in the regime where q is much larger than log n. Okay, so this is where this is the regime where we have this tangle, effect of tangles. And suppose that when we took linear combinations, they didn't cancel, right? Then that means, right? Then that means that the difference between these two guys is large for, let's say, 1 over n being greater than something e to the minus q, maybe with a constant. Right? So if you rearrange this, you just get q smaller than log, right? Greater than log. Q greater than log n means 1 over n is greater, right? So the error would have to be large in this regime where 1 over n is larger than something exponentially small in q, okay? So if we were to draw a picture of what this function would look like, so I'm drawing here a graph. Here I'm drawing this function phi h. On this axis, I'm drawing 1 over n, right? And somewhere over here at phi at 0, right? When 1 over n is 0, that means n equals infinity, the function should go to nu 0 of h. Let me choose an h for which nu 0 of h is 0. Okay, so it has to go to nu 0 of h. So we know that this function has to be 0 here. I mean, nu 0 of h doesn't have to be 0, but let me just pick an h for which it's 0. Right? On the other hand, somewhere over here I have e to the minus a constant times q, very close to 0, right? Because this is a very small number. Right? And here the function has to be large, right? Because it can only get close to this when I'm in this interval, right? On the other hand, we have an upper bound from the spectral theorem. Because you see, what do we know about phi of h? We know phi of h is the expected trace of h of a self-adjoint matrix, right? So by the spectral theorem, we know that this function is bounded, right? So we know that phi of h 1 over n, this is a trivial bound. Right? This is, in my running example, this is the adjacency matrix of a D regular graph. So all of the eigenvalues with probability 1 are between minus D and D, right? So by the spectral theorem, this must be bounded by an infinity norm, right? That's the object that's showing up over there. So we have some upper bound on what this function can be, right? It's over here somewhere. Let me just write it like that. Right? So roughly what this function would have to look like, it would have to be somewhere over here. Well, maybe it could go to zero every once in a while, but let me draw it like this. And then it would very abruptly have to go to zero. Right? So what this means is that if cancellation were to not happen, this function would look something like a step function. Right? It would have to go from something large to zero in an interval of exponentially small size in the degree q. Right? But the thing is, we know this thing behaved like a polynomial of degree q. And now there's a basic fact that polynomials of bounded degree cannot behave like step functions. Okay? If I bound the degree of a polynomial, I have a polynomial of degree q, there's only so quickly that I can go from a large number to zero. Okay? And that's the basic contradiction that happens here. So if we could quantify, and I'll do it right now, there's a very classical, this has been understood since the 1800s, that polynomials of bounded degree cannot move quickly. Polynomials of bounded degree can only move rather slowly. And therefore, we have a contradiction, right? If the cancellation didn't happen, then this thing would have to decay very, very quickly. And that's just not possible when we have polynomials of bounded degree. Okay? So the precise inequality that we use here dates back to Markov. So you all know the Markov inequality from your undergraduate courses. This is the same Markov, but a different inequality.
Name polynomial method, does it refer to the fact that we test polynomials of XF?
No. The name polynomial method is because phi h is almost a polynomial. And, I often get complaints about the name. So, because there's something called polynomial method in combinatorics, which is very popular, and the combinatorialists are very angry that this is called polynomial method, but it's their problem. So this name comes from, this idea was inspired by a technique that was used in theoretical computer science. And it's a very old technique that dates back to at least the early 1990s. And it was called the polynomial method there. And we just adapted the name. And I believe it happened before this polynomial method in combinatorics. So they should rename their method. Okay, so so it's used in the computer science application, it's used in a very different way. But it's the same idea that you can use the properties of polynomials to reason something like that. So here's an inequality that dates from the 1800s. If f is a univariate polynomial of degree q, then if I look at the derivative of f, for simplicity, I've normalized it to the interval minus 1, 1. That's the standard way it's formulated. But otherwise, you can just rescale it and get it on any interval you want. It's bounded by q squared times the L infinity norm of f. And this is optimal. Even the constant is optimal. If you plug Chebyshev polynomial of degree q into this inequality, you will get an equality. Okay? So this is the best possible. Okay? So what this is saying is that if I have a bounded polynomial, let's say a polynomial is bounded on this interval by 1, then its derivative can only grow polynomially, in fact, quadratically at worst, in the degree of the polynomial. So this prevents us from having polynomials of bounded degree that look like step functions, right? Of a small degree that look like step functions. If I wanted to have a function like this and approximate it by a polynomial, or for it to be a polynomial, the degree of the polynomial would have to be exponentially large, right? And that's simply not true over here. Does that make sense? So it's a basic fact coming from the theory of polynomials. It has absolutely nothing to do with random matrices or spectral theory or anything like that. But what this is showing for our purposes is that really you have a contradiction, right? Because on the one hand, the spectral theorem says that this function is bounded. And on the other hand, we know a priori that this is a bounded degree polynomial, right? And those two things together mean that this function cannot very quickly go from large to small. And therefore, if you had any, right, if you didn't have cancellations, you would come up with a contradiction, right? So it must be that these things cancel. And that's the basic way in which this this cancellation happens. Right. Now, to actually prove an inequality like the one I wrote on the board, you basically just reverse this argument, right? So we start with this inequality, and basically all you have to do is, let's say, take this function phi h, we Taylor expand it to first order, and then apply this inequality over here in order to get bound, right? That's how you prove it. There's a minor issue that here we can only have this uniform bound on the points 1 over n, not in the continuous interval. So you have to add an extra step, basically, to interpolate between these points 1 over n. But again, that is a standard fact from the theory of polynomials. Okay, so you can look this up in textbooks, how to do that. Right? So that's not something that we invented. Okay. So that's basically how it works. Okay? So this is the best explanation I have for this cancellation. And once you realize that you have this cancellation, the question is now, how do you use it? Right? So for the rest of my time, I want to talk a little bit about how to exploit it. And again, I won't give you a full, the details are all, each ingredient is pretty simple, okay? But I just want to give you a flavor. So maybe I should write down again the inequality that we have, right? So we have an inequality that looks like this, or at least the simplest inequality. Okay, so this is an inequality for polynomials, right? For polynomials of degree at most q. Okay. So what we do is we use a basic fact of Fourier analysis. For some reason, I was not able to locate a reference where this fact is spelled out. But the proof is I mean, okay, we put it in our paper. This proof is very simple. So the fact is the following. This is a basic fact of Fourier analysis. If I have a functional, let me say nu is a linear functional on the space of polynomials, let's say the space of real valued polynomials. So if I have a linear function on the space of real valued polynomials, so for example, the thing here inside the absolute values is a linear functional in the space of polynomials, right? Okay. So the fact is that if nu of h is bounded by something polynomial in Q, right, like this, constant times the L infinity norm of H on some interval, for all polynomials, is equivalent to saying that nu extends to a compactly supported Schwarz distribution . So in particular, for example, to go in one direction, what you get from that is an estimate that looks like nu of h is bounded by the same constant times a universal constant, times, now you do not no longer have the L infinity norm of H, but you have, let's say, the CK plus 1 norm of H on the same interval. Okay?
So the left H is at degree Q?
For all H of, yes, thank you. And all Q. Right? So here the bound depends on degree, right? Here, the bound no longer depends on degree, but it depends on the CK plus 1 norm. Okay. The converse inequality is also true. You just maybe have to have a plus 2 there or something like that. Okay. But up to some constant here, the converse is also true. Okay. You could view this as the Hausdorff moment problem for Schwarz distributions. Right? The Hausdorff has a theorem that explains for which sequences of numbers do you have a compactly supported probability measure that has dot as moments. And this is the same kind of characterization for Schwarz distributions, for compactly supported Schwarz distributions. And the proof of this is actually extremely easy, because what you have to do is you simply have to... What you have to do... Can you still hear me? All right, I'll just hold it. What you have to do is you simply take whatever your function is, let's say a smooth function, and you expand it in a basis of polynomials. And what basis of polynomials should you choose? Well, you choose that basis which has small L infinity norm. And it is known that there is such an optimal basis. This was proved by Chebyshev. Same Chebyshev, different result than the one you're used to from your probability theory course, right? It was proved by Chebyshev in the 1800s that the optimal basis is the basis of Chebyshev polynomials. I don't think he called it Chebyshev polynomials. You expand your smooth function on the basis of Chebyshev polynomials, and then you just apply this inequality term by term. And what you will get here on the right-hand side is a sum over the kth Chebyshev coefficients times q to the k. And that's exactly a Sobolev norm. Okay, so that's a basic fact of Fourier analysis. So in fact, you've got a slightly better norm here. You get a Sobolev norm rather than a CK. But for our purposes, this is not important. Okay. So what this, once you have an estimate of this form, and it's extremely important that you have here an L infinity norm of the polynomial. That's where the cancellation is coming from. But once you have an estimate like this, it's perfectly suited to pass from, let's say, analytic functional calculus to smooth functional calculus. Okay? And that's at the end of the day, what we're going to do. So we are going to play this game. So in the simplest example that I gave over here, I expanded to first order, but in fact you can do this to any order, and you will need that to go to the norm. But remember, for example, in our running example, the spectral statistics are rational functions, right? So they have an asymptotic expansion in 1 over n. You can just Taylor expand them, right? So let's call it the weak asymptotic expansion. So if we know, for example, that this is a right, so this is phi h of 1 over n, that means that it has an asymptotic expansion. So it's mu 0 of h plus 1 over n mu 1 of h. Now you see why I called it mu 0. This is just a zero order term. Q of h. Right, so this is just the Taylor expansion of that function psi, of the function phi h for any polynomial. And there is also the notion of a strong asymptotic expansion. Which is the same property. Mu zero of h plus one over n of mu one of h, etc. For smooth functions h. And in general, it's perfectly possible that you have a model where you have a weak asymptotic expansion, but not a strong asymptotic expansion. Right? In fact, if you think about it for a moment, there's absolutely no reason why this should imply that. Right? Because even in the simplest case, you see what this asymptotic expansion is saying is that the convergence of this to its limit happens at rate 1 over n for polynomial test functions. But this expansion will say that the convergence of this to its limit will happen at rate 1 over n for smooth test functions. But why should it be true that smooth functions have the same rate of convergence as polynomials? I mean, it could very well be that for smooth functions, you still have convergence, but at a slower rate. And then such a statement would not be true. Does that make sense? So in general, there's no reason why that should imply that. But the polynomial method gives us a tool to prove that once you have this, whenever the polynomial method applies, once you have this, you automatically will get it for smooth functions. Okay? Because now each of these linear functionals extends to the space of smooth functions from the space of polynomials. Okay? And the error term will also extend in exactly the same way in the asymptotic expansion. Does that make sense? And what this means is that in order to prove convergence, we are now allowed to work with smooth functions. And now the good news is that we're in familiar territory. Because it was known long ago that if you had a smooth asymptotic expansion, there was a tool of getting norm convergence from smooth asymptotic expansions. And this was realized, for example, by Hargrub and Torbjornsson. And by Schultz, who was a student of Hargrub. That what you can do is you can now, because you can work with smooth functions, let's say I want to show that the extreme eigenvalues lie in this interval. Right? What I can do is I can just work with something that has that is zero here. It looks like a test, like an indicator function. Right? I can work with a smooth function that looks like an indicator function, which is zero in the in this region, and it's about one outside. Right? And the expected trace of this function basically counts how many eigenvalues we have outside of this interval minus 2 square root d minus 1 to 2 square root d minus 1. So if we can show that the number of eigenvalues we have outside this interval goes to zero on average, then we have proved norm convergence. So this requires you, in this case, to control nu 0 and nu 1, and I'm not talking about that part of it, but that is something that also is something that was already understood before our work, that one could compute, that one can control, let's say, individual terms in this expansion. Okay? So the really key point here is that once we have enough control over how these objects behave, we are allowed to pass the smooth functions, and then we can use this technology that was already in place to get norm convergence. Okay? Now the question is, why wasn't this done before? And the answer is that, you see, this method over here of using smooth asymptotic expansions is widely used in the literature, for example, on strong convergence. Okay? So this is a well-known phenomenon over here. But the problem is that in all of the cases in which it was used, how do you prove such an expansion? They had to work directly with statistics that are not polynomials. For example, what Hagrup and Bjornsson do is they get such expansions for the expected resolvent of the random matrices. And once you have the expected resolvent, you can use complex analysis to pass the smooth functions. And they're able to do this because they work with Gaussian matrices, and you can do things like integration by parts. You have lots of tools in order to compute, to work with spectral statistics directly, which are not polynomials. But in kind of models like random graphs, it's very difficult to work directly with such spectral statistics. Really, the only thing that we know how to compute, well, for random graphs, now there are some other tools that were developed by the Yao group. But for more general models over here, really the only things that we can compute are these polynomial spectral statistics. Like, we just don't know how to directly work with non-polynomial statistics. And so the reason that this technology is very useful in such complicated models is because it allows us to start with something that we can compute, and it allows us to deduce such expansions that were not accessible before in models like this. Okay. So, you know, I've skipped many, many details, okay? So, you know, to actually make it work, you need to know a few things. For example, you need to understand how to compute the supports of these distributions. And we have various tools to do this. You also need to understand, I said that the phi h is approximately a polynomial, okay? But that's a chicken and egg problem, right? Because I want to find cancellation, right? And I use the fact that I assumed it's a polynomial in order to get cancellation. Now, of course, anything that's sufficiently smooth, you can approximate it by a polynomial, by Taylor expansion. But if you don't have, if you lose the cancellation in the error terms, then you've defeated the purpose of what you're doing, right? So there are some tricks involved in not losing when you approximate phi h by a polynomial. Okay? But at the end of the day, I think I hope that I've given you some kind of flavor of at the bottom, these are technical aspects of the method. And I hope I've given you some flavor of this weird cancellation and why it shows. So let me end there. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.